Barron, thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight, Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman. On the show tonight...
Many black men have been falsely accused.
Mayor Johnson reacts to one of the largest police misconduct settlements in the city's history. Carol Moseley Braun was the first black woman ever elected to the U.S. Senate. 30 years later, the ambassador is taking on a new role. We'll talk with her one-on-one. And another first black woman joins us. Olympic medalist Debbie Thomas is in Chicago to promote diversity in figure skating. Chicago taxpayers will pay $50 million to four men who spent a combined 73 years in prison after being wrongfully convicted of a 1995 double murder based on coerced confessions. After today's unanimous vote, the men, known as the Marquette Park Four, said no amount of money could return the years they lost due to Chicago police misconduct. WTTW News reporter Heather Sharon joins us now from outside City Hall. Heather, let's listen to what Mayor Johnson told you about this settlement.
Many black men have been falsely accused and, you know, spent, you know, their lives in prison for a crime they did not commit. You know, unfortunately, this is the experience of many black men who, whether they get accused of a crime or they are reduced to some sort of caricature. So there is a lot of work that obviously has to be done to reform our police department, but keep in mind the cases that we are settling are the direct result of what previous administrations ignored.
Heather, is he right? Is this kind of police misconduct in the past?
Well, Johnson promised again today to chart a new path for the Chicago Police Department, which has been beset by decades of scandals caused by police misconduct and brutality. There have been seven full-throated efforts to reform the CPD, none of which have been successful. And the city is in full compliance with just 7% of the federal court order known as the consent decree, which is designed to change the department's culture and prevent misconduct like this one, like alleged in this case, from ever happening again.
This is one of the largest police misconduct settlements in the city's history. Heather, how did we get here? What went wrong?
Well, this is really part of the legacy of former Commander John Birch, who tortured and abused hundreds of black men for decades, in many cases to coerce confessions. Now, the detectives who are alleged to have coerced the confessions in this case reported to Birch and were trained by him. And this is really an indication that even though this case took place 30 years ago, the city is still grappling with the legacy left by Burge and the officers that he trained.
Heather, this wasn't the only police misconduct lawsuit resolved today by the city council. Tell us about the other one.
So the city will pay $2 million to the family of Ronald Johnson III, who is better known as Ronnie Man. He was shot and killed by a Chicago police officer in 2014, just 8 days before a similar incident took the life of Laquan McDonald. Now, in the McDonald case, the officer, of course, Jason Van Dyke, was charged and convicted of second-degree murder. The officer in this case, George Hernandez, remains on the force today, has never faced discipline for his actions in this case, and earns more than $110,000 a year.
Heather, before we let you go, we're halfway through the year. What has it cost Chicago taxpayers to settle these police misconduct suits?
In less than 6 months, Chicago taxpayers have paid $60 million to resolve more than 50 cases alleging a wide range of misconduct, and the city's insurance carrier has paid out an additional $45 million, including $29 million in the case of the so-called Marquette Park Four. We will have to see whether the city can even come in under budget under the $82 million it set aside this year to cover the cost of police misconduct settlements. That seems unlikely at this point.
Six more months to find out, Heather. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brandon.
And you can read Heather's full story on our website. That's WTTW.com/news.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
Carol Moseley Braun made history in 1993 when she became the first black woman ever elected to the U.S. Senate. Over the years, she's worn a lot of political hats, including Congresswoman, Cook County Recorder of Deeds, and, of course, Ambassador. She's taking on a new role now as the chair of the United States African Development Foundation. And joining us now is Carol Moseley Braun. Ambassador, welcome to the show. We're glad to have you.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, as we mentioned, you became the first black woman to ever be elected to the U.S. Senate. That was in 1992. And you're one of only three black women to have ever held the title. We've all heard of the second one, who is now Vice President Kamala Harris. The third is LaFonza Butler. Why haven't there been more?
Well, it's cultural. And mostly it has to do with the fact that women have not been getting elected to the Senate. It's the highest legislative body we have in this country. And there's been a kind of a cultural bias to have women making those kinds of decisions. So I was glad to be part, I was honored to be part of the largest class of women ever elected to the United States Senate. And there were eight of us out of 100.
What progress do you think has been made in that kind of representation since you took office?
I think a lot. I think attitudes have changed. People are now accustomed, more accustomed to women in decision-making roles, are more accustomed to the fact that women are out there, you know, changing the world. And, of course, our vice president is very important part of that because she's taken such an aggressive role in terms of actual policy things that make that impact people's lives and make a difference.
How do you respond to you know, some folks make the argument that race shouldn't matter. A candidate's ideology, a candidate's fitness for the job is what's most important, not, you know, having a diverse amount of candidates and elected officials.
Well, you know something, you know, two things can be right, can be true, that sound contradictory. And this is one of the places where it is true. You want to have the best quality candidates, people who can do the job and who have a real sense of connectedness to what it is that they're doing. That it's not about them, it's about the people they represent, and who are prepared and able to represent the entirety of their constituency. That's the most important thing. Does race matter? It matters a lot. But that has to do with the ability to fundraise, that has to do with the ability to get votes out, and to overcome biases that are implicit that people don't talk about. Things like, you know, what kind of clothes you wear, what color is your lipstick, that sort of thing. You know, those things persist among women, but the men don't have to deal with, you know.
On that point, though, you know, there has been no black woman to ever be elected as a governor in the United States. We just talked about the Senate, and there's only been a handful. Ketanji Brown Jackson, obviously, making history, being the first black woman to be appointed to the Supreme Court. Do you feel like black women as candidates, are they getting enough support from the party, whichever party they may choose, and donors when they're seeking one of those higher offices?
Well, it's a process. And even getting a fundraising operation, you have to be able to attract the talent of people who can do it. And frankly, a lot of the professionals in this industry just won't take on black female candidates because they think that they have less of a chance to have the headlines and to raise the kind of money that's required, because it's millions of dollars. And again, it's not for the candidate. The candidate doesn't see a penny of that. It all goes to the consultants, to the people who do television, who do the field operation. It goes to all the people who do different parts of campaign. And it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. And that's what I think people should focus on, the fact that it is a multi-billion-dollar industry and that minorities are not getting a fair share of it, in spite of their participation in the elections and the fact that voting behavior. But either way, I listened to some Hispanic experts on the radio today, and they complain, have the same complaints, because they don't get the same attention either. The ability to raise the money, the kind of support, the assumptions that go into it, it's all cultural at the end of the day. And so until we get the cultural issues solved, which we're all working on, and that's why your show is so important. No, seriously, we're all working on getting the cultural issues addressed and solved.
And when you say cultural, you mean sort of the recognition and acceptance of someone of a different culture having a chance, having a shot at
exactly.
Winning the office.
And even gender. I mean, gender plays as strong a role as culture does. I was just the other day, I'm working on a book, and one of the parts that I did not put in the book for myself, but I'd written previously, was that Abigail Adams, one of our founding mothers, right, had written to her husband saying, you know, you got to be nicer to the ladies. You know, it goes back to that. So
that hasn't changed.
It hasn't changed at all. You know, so here she was complaining that the women were getting, not getting the same kind of support that other Americans were. And this Abigail Adams in the 1700s. So, you know, we've come a ways, but it's been a fight all along the way, and it will continue to be a point of contention as men, frankly, are challenged by it, and a lot of women, too, are challenged by it.
So, you know, on the subject of voting behaviors, presidential election, as we know, steadily approaching. And the Pew Research Center says that half of black voters that they polled said they would replace both candidates, both President Trump and, I mean, excuse me, President Biden and former President Trump with completely different candidates. Obviously, that's in a perfect, not perfect world, but perfect for those people who were surveyed. That's not happening. But can President Biden rely on black voters in this election?
Oh, you never do that. I wouldn't advise that of him. For him or any other candidate. You don't rely on anything. When I ran for statewide office, my view was, you know, people talk about the base. My view was you go after the votes you don't have, and then the folks that people predict will vote for you will fall in place if they think you can win. And so I would give this President Biden the same recommendation as count the black vote. Don't count it out, but count on it to come in and be the save the day, if you will.
You know, there's been talk of a Blexit for a while, is what they're calling it. Black voters leaving the Democratic Party in favor of the Republicans or any other, maybe third party, for example, especially since the rise of some figures like Candace Owens. How can Biden and other Democrats energize the black vote if that's what they feel like they need to go after?
Well, a lot of it depends on explaining to people what their vote means, how important it is. A lot of black people that I talk to don't think their vote matters. And so you start there, the basic stuff. It does matter, and it's really important, and this is why it's important that you get engaged with this process and that you vote. I think going back to the basics, connecting with people in terms of what it is you actually have done as opposed to just words, those are the kinds of things. It's old-fashioned, basic politics, but if you talk to the voters about what they care about, then they'll come to your rescue.
Let's talk a little bit about your new role. You were appointed to serve as chair, as we mentioned, of the United States African Development Foundation back in April. Big task to take on. It's a big continent. Not everybody, people don't know a lot about Africa, right? 54 very different and diverse countries on the entire continent, different interests and issues and assets. What are some of your first priorities?
My first priority is to engage with this agency and to make it relevant to the people on the continent. And explain to Americans what it does and why it's relevant, why it's important to support. This agency has been around since the 1960s. It started with the Kennedys, the other Kennedys that were before, right? And so it's been around for a long time. I didn't even know about it. And I've been in the United States Senate and then an ambassador. I did not know about this agency. And so if I didn't know about it, then what's the chance of somebody who's, you know, just going to pick their kid up from school would know about it? Close to none. So I think familiarizing voters with the agency, what it does, why it's important, particularly since the Russians and the Chinese are in there big time trying to curry favor with different African nations, and they are very different. 54 countries is a whole continent. It's even more diverse than, you know, Mississippi and California, okay? So there's lots of challenges on the continent, but I think we stand for, our values are such, and are so important, that it's really important that we engage in convincing people that these values of democracy, of fairness, make a difference, and it's important for them too, not just for us.
As we've discussed, you've had a very long and impressive career spanning 3 decades, 6 presidents. Of course, you're still at it. What are you most proud of, and what do you feel there is remaining for you to do?
Well, I'm doing it now, actually. I'm most proud of the fact that the people of Illinois sent me to the Senate. I mean, I broke through a barrier that had been there for years, and because of the people of Illinois. And so I'm very proud of that and grateful for it. You know, so I've had a career that's been really fun. I've tried to make it fun. There have been some times that were not so much fun, but at the same time, I've tried to make it fun, and it certainly has taught me a lot. I've learned a lot about the world.
Okay. That we're out of time. I've enjoyed having you here, and thank you for joining us. And I would look forward to having you back when you're done with that book that you mentioned. I heard that, and it did not get by me. So, Ambassador Carol Mosley-Braun, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ms. Friedman. Appreciate it.
Up next, a nationwide effort to diversify figure skating comes to Chicago. We meet with the founder and their all-star guest. It was 1988 when crowds watched figure skater Debbie Thomas jump and spin her way to becoming the first black woman to win a medal at an Olympic Winter Games. But nearly 40 years later, the sport has yet to see another African-American win a senior national championship or attract many skaters of color. Our next guests are now working to make skating more accessible and show what can be achieved through mentorship, sponsorship, and fun. Joining us now with more are Joel Savory, former figure skater and founder of Diversify Ice Fellowship and Foundation, and 1988 Olympic bronze medalist Debbie Thomas. Thanks to you both for joining us. Looking forward to this conversation.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Joel, starting with you first, you've often shared your own story about not always feeling welcome in the sport. How did you overcome that?
Well, for me, I was very lucky because I had a younger brother who was really anxious and eager to follow my footsteps. So we kind of were always just together on the ice at the rink. So I found sort of solace just having my brother there. My parents were always just being very supportive and, you know, do what you want, do what you love, and, you know, we're going to be there for you. And to really just lock out and shut out everyone else that's kind of pushing, you know, you down with the stereotypes of, you know, people don't look like you in the ice rink, so you can't do it. So I think just that community was very important for me.
Talk a little bit about the state of diversity in figure skating now and, you know, how you came to create Diversify Ice.
Yeah, unfortunately, figure skating is very much a monochromatic sport. So really just one shade of skin is on the ice rink. You're going to see really not many people of color. We're starting now, thanks to Diversify Ice and just a lot of effort around the country of many skaters trying to really push diversity, to see sprinkles here and there of some diversity on the ice. And, you know, that's what we're trying to do at Diversify Ice Foundation is we're trying to bring more people into the sport. So what we have at our Skate Razor is a really exciting thing because it's going to be a combination of past, present, and future from Olympians like Ty Babylonia and Debbie Thomas to current stars like Star Andrews, and then the next generation of figure skaters that are coming in, and we kind of guide them through a pathway to be meet these stars and have a great feedback loop of this is what I want to do, and I can have a pathway to understand how to get there.
Debbie Thomas, did you realize during your skating career that you were the first black woman at your level in the role that you would go on to play in the history of the sport?
Well, it's interesting because I actually didn't really focus on my race coming up through skating. And sometimes I sort of feel like if my mom had made that a factor, would it have affected me negatively? Like, would I have put certain limitations on myself or, you know, taken on a almost victimization sort of role? My story is really interesting because when I first got introduced to figure skating, I mean, I didn't know anything about the Olympics or anything like that. My mom took me to a lot of different things like, you know, the symphony and the opera and the ballet and musicals and ice shows. And ironically, the person that appealed to me in the ice show was the comedian, guy named Mr. Frick, who looked absolutely nothing like me. He was like a Swiss guy that wore lederhosen, and that's who I idolized. And that's who, when I first started skating, who I would imitate and things like that. So it was funny many years later when I finally made it to my first world championship and they were asking me how I got into skating, and I told my story about Mr. Frick, and he saw it on TV and he wrote to me and said, thank you for the tribute. And years, you know, later, a couple years later, when I won my world championship, I actually did a very famous comedy number named Wanda Beazle, and really followed in my idol's footsteps, who, like I said, looked nothing like me.
Well, and I've seen like a bit of him skating, and obviously we've all seen lots of you skating, and they don't look anything alike. And so I love that story that he that he is your idol.
Right. I mean, I knew nothing about the Olympics or anything, and you know, and I don't even think really thinking about that I could become the first Black athlete from any country in any sport to medal in the Winter Olympics. I almost didn't get a medal. I skated so badly in the free program. I almost didn't get that bronze medal.
Well, and I just want to get Joel back in here, because, you know, it's been a few years since you did win that medal and since you did accomplish all of that. Joel, why do you think there haven't been more Black and brown skaters since Debbie Thomas?
Well, Debbie has been such a iconic person in the sport, and we're so glad to have her, and we would love to see so many more skaters of color come through. There's just a lot of barriers within the sport right now, many of which is very systemic. So number one, the sport is incredibly expensive. So many of us people of color are priced out of the sport. Number two, there's this biased judging mindset as well. So, you know, oftentimes many skaters of color will do the exact same elements, sometimes even harder, and they feel that their scores are much lower. So how do we combat that? And then the sense of community. There's really no community there in the sport until Diversify Ice Foundation came along, of course. But to look around and be an ice rink and being the only one and not knowing who's really in your corner, I think it could be very, very difficult. So Diversify Ice Foundation, we're, you know, pushing for providing those sponsorships, mentorships, networks, and opportunities to broaden that, to connect us all, and to hopefully get us to the next level. So we are seeing some changes now, of course, that we just mentioned. Star Andrews, who will also be at the Skate Razor this weekend, and many others, my brother Emmanuel Savory.
You've been working with skaters at Howard University to help them their own team, which is the first ever at an HBCU. And, you know, you've been coaching for a long time. You mentioned your brother Emmanuel, who's gone on to win some titles, competing internationally as well. How do you encourage skaters and educate them about the sport? Because a lot of them don't even see it as an option for themselves.
Yeah, you know, just even talking about the Howard team, like many of them didn't know that they could actually do this. So having a Howard figure skating team really opened the door to many others being able to say, hey, I can skate and be a college student. And then also for many other students that want to come into this, or, you know, they can say, wow, I can have a coach that looks like me. Wow, I can connect myself with Olympic Debbie Thomas. Maybe I actually have an opportunity to be a figure skater at a national Olympic level.
Debbie Thomas, you know, in your work with Joel and Diversify Ice, what do you say to a young skater who says, I want to be the next Debbie Thomas? Or what do you say to that next generation to encourage them as well and let them know that they can do it?
Well, when I was coming up through skating, I think I didn't realize the impact that I had until I started getting fan mail from skaters and moms, and I realize that there are people out there that do feel like they need to identify with someone who looks like themselves. But usually what I tell kids is, look, you don't have to see somebody who looks like you to do what you want to do in life. And, you know, we can't make other people sort of see us a certain way. But my mom used to always just tell me, you know, she wouldn't say, oh, you didn't get what you deserve because you were Black. She never said that to me through my entire career. But if I didn't win, she would just say, well, you need to get better next time. And I kept getting better and better, and eventually it gets to be undeniable. And, you know, to be fair, very few people make it to the Olympics in figure skating in any race. And With hyperinflation and things like that, figure skating is pricing out most people. And a lot of what I'm interested in working on is other ways to make figure skating where you can sort of get some return on your investment. There's a skater by the name of Valdez.
It's okay. We are just out of time, but I love what you said. You don't have to see somebody who looks like you to do what you want to do. But I am going to tell people that they can get more, that they can learn more about this. But in the meantime, I'm going to thank the two of you, Debbie Thomas and Joel Savory. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And again, as Joel mentioned, the Skate Razor 2024 show is happening in Chicago this Saturday. You can visit our website for more information. And that is our show tonight. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10 for Chicago Tonight Latino Voices. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight Black Voices, I'm Brandis Friedman. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm, and proud sponsor of programming that offers advice and strategies to enhance the physical and mental well-being of fellow legal practitioners in Illinois.